Veterans Service Budget Reform Order. Today is Wednesday, January 22nd. Are you picking me up okay, Kelly? Are you still picking me up okay? All right. I was afraid of that.
I know.
Talk into the microphone. Today, in fact, today is the first day we are going to start a series over the next couple of weeks of overview information. I would call this an in-depth overview on the healthcare marketplace. We're going to look at private providers. We're going to look at public healthcare systems. It is not going to be fair to call this 101 because we are going to get fairly detailed. This is going to be a fairly comprehensive couple of weeks. I would encourage the committee members, at least with Mr. DePreet, to ask questions as we go. This is going to be some detailed, involved stuff, and it's critical that we have a comprehensive understanding of this material as we go. So ask questions, but try, please, to stay on topic to the point that is being discussed, not to make another point at that time. We'll have plenty of opportunity to make those points as we go along. The committee should keep in mind that these presentations, while they may seem somewhat unrelated to one another, they are all very interrelated to each other and the Oregon Health Plan. This is a very complex, involved, interrelated system that we have developed here in Oregon, and that's what the charge of this committee is to do, is to look at it from all sides, all facets, over, under, sideways, down. The I think today the we should probably shoot going to about 4:30, and then we'll be back tomorrow with Mr. DePreet, and maybe also on Monday for a recap, reassessment, maybe think of some questions over the weekend, spend some more time with Mr. DePreet on Monday. So I think that will be our schedule. We'll shoot to go to about 4:30 today for the audience and committee members. I don't know if there's anything else that I should say as we really start our first day of hearings for the Audit and Human Services Budget Reform Committee. Did I leave anything out?
No, Mr. Chair, I think you covered it pretty good.
Well, I did one thing right today. Mark it down. And it's on the record. With that, Mr. DePreet, please proceed.
Thank you. I'm Bob DePreet, Deputy Administrator for the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. I'm glad to be here today to get started on discussion of an extremely complex topic. What I'm going to try and do with the presentation you have a copy of is a tour, if you will, of some of the main issues in healthcare financing and delivery, both in the private marketplace and with public programs. And if you look at the second page of this handout, you'll see the objectives of my presentation. I want to provide an overview of the healthcare system, if you wish to term it a system. Identify the factors, drivers, and trends that affect costs in the Oregon Health Plan as a part of that system. Identify stakeholder responses, or at least likely responses, to the pressures we're feeling these days. Set the context for upcoming presentations on the Oregon Health Plan, including the FEOP program. And suggest some health policy questions that we might want to address. Now, if there are other objectives that or issues that you'd like me to discuss, please let me know, and I'll pull together information on those as quickly as I can.
Yeah, I think this is a very good roadmap of where I would like you to go, and I think you have captured it very well. Thank you.
Good. So the topics involved, as you'll see on page 3, are the system, insurance status in Oregon and nationally, the managed care context, and levels of enrollment, linkages among the parts of the system, and cost levels, cost drivers, and cost trends. And that includes inflation and utilization, what we're seeing in Oregon and nationally, and the implications of the cost factors for the stakeholders. nationally and in Oregon, the healthcare system isn't really a system at all. It wasn't designed as a coherent system. It came into being one piece at a time over about the last 75 years or so. Healthcare finance and delivery are fragmented. You don't have to look at what we have in place very long to realize that it's not tightly put together. There are lots of gaps, lots of duplication. Programs are many, and the responsibilities of those programs are usually not as clear as we'd like them to be. These programs overlap, and they leave gaps, which cause people to not have access to health care, not have health insurance. Some people are doubly insured, and others have no insurance at all. The funding is piecemeal and haphazard, and it involves the federal government, state governments, counties, cities, employer and employee financing, and charity care provided by physicians and hospitals and other providers. Again, this is not a system. It's what we've managed to patch together to try and cover the cost of care. The delivery systems that provide care are convoluted, and they have to fight to preserve some level of efficiency against the tide of the fragmentation. And the form of the delivery system, frankly, follows the funding. So since the funding is fragmented, the delivery system is fragmented as well. The tax codes, state and federal, contribute to the fragmentation. The tax codes contain subsidies, sometimes not always very clear, that affect how health care and health insurance are financed. The subsidies in the tax code and elsewhere are complicated. They're often hidden. We don't realize they're there or how they're working. They're sometimes unintentional, even when they're pretty powerful. And they contribute to instability and inequity in the system, because, again, the subsidies were not systematically put in place. When you get to how this feels to folks involved in the system, providers often feel underpaid. Purchasers feel overcharged for what they're getting for their money. Patients feel overlooked, feel that their needs are not always primary in the system's objectives. And all parties involved feel at risk because things are changing rapidly and in ways that make most of us uncomfortable, whether we provide care, consume care, pay for care, or simply trying to figure out how to solve the problems. Now, the Oregon Health Plan came into being in that context 8 or 10 years ago, and it has all or most of the characteristics, good and bad, of the general health care finance and delivery system. When you see a problem, yes.
What you just described to us sounds like the system as it exists today. Has it always been this way? Is that what you're saying?
No. I think it's been this way or getting this way for at least the past 10, 15, 20 years. I think there are factors that are coming more into play that make it clearer that the system's not working. But I think it always had faults because it was not systematically put together. So I think what we're seeing is the results of an inefficient, ineffective healthcare system having worked or not worked over a couple of decades. And as resources become tighter, all the symptoms of the problems with the system become more evident.
And I appreciate that question, because what I think I heard you say was that this pace towards unsustainability is accelerating.
That's right.
And that is the system based on knee-jerk responses to given situations as opposed to a prospective design addressed to anticipate the needs, changing needs of the American society.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
That's what I think is going on. The Oregon Health Plan is Oregon's Medicaid reform plan, a health plan for low-income individuals and families. But in fact, it broadens Medicaid to include people who aren't usually eligible for Medicaid, and it includes a benefit package that was designed as a part of this health reform effort that's unlike anything that's been put into place anywhere else. It currently provides health care to over 460,000 Oregonians, if you count all components, and that's the Medicaid demonstration portion of the program, the CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, a fairly recent program aimed at uninsured children, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEOP, which subsidizes private coverage, and the high-risk pool. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, or OMIP, which covers people who are uninsured and have been turned down for insurance on the open marketplace because of pre-existing conditions. So this is a program for those folks who are identified as having a chronic health problem that gets in the way of their getting insurance on the open market. All told, about $460,000.
Representative Belto?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. How large is the client population in the high-risk pool?
Representative Belto, Mr. Chair, in the high-risk pool, we have currently, I believe, about 8,000 or 9,000 enrolled.
Thank you.
In fact, could you give the numbers for all of those as we go down that you've already given?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Medicaid demonstration project is, and including CHIP, is about 460,000. Of those, about 460,000. And of those, about 440,000 are Medicaid and about 20,000 are CHIP. The Family Health Insurance Assistance Program has about 4,000 enrollees currently. And the OMIP program, the high-risk pool, has about 8,000 or 9,000.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a point of interest, well, I guess 2 points of interest, really. A little math before I saw you sitting there. We've been sitting across a dais from each other for 14 years.
Has been.
And we've never been on the same side yet. And we also both had hair in those days.
We did.
Okay?
We did.
So it's been a long haul, Bob.
It has.
Okay.
You've known Representative Bates for that long. I now know what's the matter with you, and I forgive you.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your understanding.
And before we're through, he'll be bald. Okay. what's the waiting list for the FEOP program at this time? People who want to get on it and haven't been able to be served yet. You know what that number is?
Representative Bates, Mr. Chair, it's approximately 20,000, but I'm going to defer to Kelly Harms.
And that's the individual. The group market is how many?
The group market is on hand. So people coming in who are eligible for the insurance
are getting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you get that?
Perfect. A follow-up question.
Sure.
How much capacity do we now have in group that's underutilized? Do you understand the question? Okay. I guess the point behind that is that in this population, it's harder to qualify for group, and so while it's cheaper, we can get a lot of folks in individually, but it's harder to get people that in that population that are qualified to enter in group. So,
and we're going to spend a good deal of time on FEOP in depth and detail next week sometime. So. Not to stifle debate, but please move on, sir.
Good job.
The Oregon Health Plan builds on a series of legislative actions that have been passed over the last 14 years, as mentioned, aimed at ensuring access to affordable health care for all Oregonians. It's worth noting that the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan included in its design an employer mandate, which was rescinded, repealed. And almost immediately after the repeal of the employer mandate, we began working on an alternative, a voluntary alternative that would allow us to engage the private sector and encourage people to encourage employers to offer and employees to accept employer-sponsored insurance.
Bob, could you just define that employer mandate real quick?
The employer mandate? It's the employer mandate required that employers contribute to the cost of health insurance for all full-time employees and their dependents. At a level, as I recall, it was going to be 75% of the individual premium and 50% of the family premium. And if an employer offered health insurance that met those requirements, that was the end of it. If the employer did not, the employer was going to be required to pay into a pool that would pay for health insurance for those employees who couldn't get it through that employer. So it was going to be a play or pay employer mandate. And that term simply means you either play by offering health insurance that meets the requirements of the program, or you pay into a pool to finance health insurance for those workers.
Mr. Chair, clarification. Yes, thank you. Was that a legislatively passed employer mandate, or was that an initiative, or and what year did that occur?
Representative Merkley, Mr. Chair, that was legislatively passed. It was passed in 1989. I think it was Senate Bill 935.
Thank you.
There were some prohibitions of that in ERISA, as I understand.
Correct.
There were federal prohibitions.
There's federal law, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, that forbids states from regulating what are called self-insured employers. These are employers, usually large employers, that provide insurance themselves directly to their employees. And that was a barrier, a federal barrier, to actually implementing an employer mandate.
Thank you.
Representative Delco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to understand that, make sure I understand this correctly. So what you're saying is this employer mandate was a requirement on employers. If they did not offer a health insurance package for employees, they were required, mandated, to pay into or in health plan system for anybody not covered, regardless of what other circumstances might have been. You're either offering a plan, employees are able to participate in that plan, or you have to pay for the employees that are not in that plan.
Representative Dalton, Mr. Chair, that is essentially correct. The requirement was either offer health insurance to full-time employees and their dependents, or pay through an assessment to pay for health insurance.
Please proceed, sir.
On the next page is a brief description of the Medicaid program, and I don't want to spend too much time on this. I just want to make the point that it's a state and federal partnership. And, in fact, the way that partnership works is that the federal government pays more than half the cost of the Medicaid program. In Oregon, the federal government pays just about 60% of the cost of the Medicare program. They also make an awful lot of the rules that we either have to abide by or get waivers from so that we have more flexibility than we would have if we had to follow all of the Medicaid regulations. The Medicaid program was begun, enacted in 1965, so it's been around a long time now. Medicaid programs vary a great deal from state to state, unlike Medicare. Who does Medicaid cover? Nationally, about 36 million people. In Oregon, about 440,000, about 460,000 if you include the CHIP children. States decide which groups their Medicaid programs will cover and the financial criteria for eligibility, but in order to receive federal funds, you must cover certain groups that the federal government has considered to be medically vulnerable. This includes children of low income, families, pregnant women, the blind, and the disabled. And these are referred to as categorical eligibles because they fall into one of those categories.
Thank you, Chair. As a percentage of our population covered by Medicaid, is there something, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but how that compares to other states in terms of percentage of their populations to Oregon. Do we cover a greater portion, a smaller portion of people under Medicaid?
This is recollection on my part, Mr. Chair. I believe it's roughly 25% of the Medicaid population is aged, blind, disabled. Now, when you add the children, you're well above that number, and you're including all the categorical eligibles. If there is someone here from the Medicaid program, I would again defer to the program folks as to what the composition is in Oregon. I don't know if we're here. No one here. Okay.
13 and 14. Here's your percentages for.
What does Medicaid cover? Again, this varies from state to state. States determine coverage within federal requirements or seek federal waivers so they can have more flexibility. And a centerpiece of Oregon's Medicaid demonstration project is the benefit package. I won't go into any great detail on this, but it's based on a prioritized list developed by the Health Services Commission, of which Representative Bates was a founding member. And the Health
right.
Services
get me in trouble again. Thanks very much.
The Health Services Commission developed a list that was based on input from the public and from providers, and also looked at relative cost factors. And this was a point of great contention with the federal government. They did not wish to give us the waiver to do benefits based on priorities. Nowadays, the federal government is more amenable to states altering benefit packages and eligibility rules. We got a subsequent waiver from the federal government for our Medicaid program just this last year to allow us to implement OHP standard, which again restructured the benefit package and gave us greater flexibility on benefits. We may go back again. It may be necessary at some point in the future to approach the federal government yet another time and ask for further waivers. Fortunately, the folks who make these decisions are becoming more and more understanding of the bind that states find themselves in as they try to do what they want to with their Medicaid programs, given the increasingly tight limits on revenues.
Question, Mr. Chair. Would it be safe to say that, I mean, we were kind of the first out of the box, and virtually everybody's joined the mad dash since, and I think there's 44 some states currently have Medicaid waivers. Would it be safe to say that there are other states that have asked for and received greater flexibility in some aspects than we have?
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I would say that is correct. An example is the state of Utah, which has, for its expansion population, a benefit package which does not include hospital inpatient care, which
we thought was extraordinary that they would ask for something below mandates, but they did and they got it, which I think is interesting. But
linkages among the parts. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about the healthcare system having to do with the fact that if you pull at it in one point in the system, you see some kind of reaction to that action elsewhere in the system. It's almost always true that the changes we make or the reforms or the mistakes that we make in dealing with the healthcare finance and delivery system show results everywhere throughout the system. A good example is uninsurance leading to cost shift. The uninsured often can't pay for care, but illness is inevitable, so they seek care and they receive care. And that means that someone else has to pay for the care that they receive when they can't pay for it themselves. Inadequate payments are another example. You have inadequate payments in one part of the system leading to cost shift elsewhere in the system. A good example of this, I suppose, is the recent Medicare reductions in payments to physicians. I'd ask Representative Bates to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was a 5% reduction that took effect last budget cycle, and that there's another 4 or 5% with a stop on it, but it's sort of waiting to be released in the next budget cycle. If that happens, that increases pressure on other purchases of care to make up the difference if the payment doesn't cover the cost of care. So someone tries to achieve savings somewhere in the healthcare finance system, often someone else has to pick up the tab for that elsewhere in the system. It's interconnected, even if it's not an efficient system, unfortunately. Inadequate access to effective primary care also leads to avoidable specialty care, unavoidable emergency care, unavoidable hospital admissions. This results in increased costs, and often the people who have inadequate access to effective primary care are uninsured or underinsured or at least low income and have difficulty paying. So why health insurance? Before World War II, health insurance wasn't all that common. It became increasingly common during the war and with the coverage of union employees and factories, and now it's an expectation that most of us have. We look to insurance to protect our assets if we have assets. We don't want an illness to lead us to bankruptcy. This is a very important issue for people with means. For those people, their concern is usually not access to routine care. Their concern is what's going to happen if someone in the family gets very sick. Asset protection is less important to those without means, who have as their primary concern, usually, being able to afford access to any care at all. Access to care as an objective of health insurance is connected with the whole idea of health maintenance. The health maintenance organization, or HMO phenomenon, has at its core a commitment to maintaining health, to making sure that people get the primary care and the preventive care that they need, and that health is restored and then maintained. And health insurance, when it promotes access to care, can make outpatient care affordable to people who otherwise would not be able to seek it. And then the third thing that we look to health insurance for is risk management. And one way to explain this is simply that we rely on insurers to help assure some degree of predictability and equity in who bears the cost of care, so that the cost gets spread across a broader base and there are fewer bad surprises for patients or purchasers of care. What does it mean not to have insurance? There's a very good study out by the American Society of Internal Medicine entitled No Health Insurance, It's Enough to Make You Sick. And the point that they make is that there is a lot of studies that have been published on the effects of going without health insurance. And what you see is that people without insurance generally have higher mortality, about 25% higher than the folks who have insurance. And they have much higher in-hospital mortality, over three times the in-hospital mortality. They also have up to four times, they're up to four times as likely to require avoidable hospitalizations and avoidable emergency care for conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, pneumonia, bleeding ulcers, and asthma. Again, this is an example of how cost shift comes about. Someone goes without routine care that could stabilize them, keep them relatively healthy, and lo and behold, they get very sick. They go into the hospital. If they're not insured or they're underinsured, somebody else has to pay for that.
Mr. Chair, assuming that everybody eventually dies, how do they determine mortality? I mean, is this by age group or what is it? I mean, you know, I'm assuming everybody with insurance and without insurance eventually dies, so I don't know how 25% more uninsured people die than... That confuses me. Is there an explanation for that?
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I believe, I'm not a professional researcher, I believe they have looked at factors such as age and income and employment status and so forth and tried to make corrections for all of those. And then look at experience with mortality rates at various ages, and see what the rates are for those with insurance and without.
Well, one would assume there are other factors other than insurance that play into that. So,
the studies I've seen, what we're really talking about is premature mortality, obviously, dying before one would expect, and they put them in cohorts so that the same socioeconomic factors, smoking and non-smoking, drinking and non-drinking, are factored into that, so you really have a really comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. They've done a pretty good job of doing that. So what they try to do is look at all those things and say, does having insurance or not having insurance really make a difference or not? And the studies indicate that, in fact, it does. In fact, it does. Primarily because of preventative care, probably.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I think the word rates probably would clarify it better rather than saying generally higher mortality. It should be generally higher mortality rates, correct?
Representative Mann, that's a good point. Yes.
I'm just happy Representative Merkley didn't challenge the assumption that everybody dies.
We could.
Well, we don't know that for a fact because.
We don't know.
It's true.
We could talk about that, but let's not. Did you have a follow up?
No, I guess statistics are statistics. And this. You know, I there are other factors, and they can try to make it apples and apples and oranges, but there are some lifestyle things in here that differ for different socioeconomic groups, clearly. So, not that this isn't a factor, but I would say this is not the sole factor that...
So we need a copy of the study to satisfy Representative Cruz's interest in this subject. Thank you.
I like... Representative Anderson's word change.
Oh, boy.
Okay. No, I'm fine now, relatively speaking, Mr. Chair.
The relatively rate of speaking.
You're right. Let's get to that.
Thank you, Chair. Bob, are there any studies that tie then other economic impacts, for example, lost work when people are hospitalized more, kind of the ripple effect of being sick more often, more hospitalizations, what that does to the general economy of that population?
Mr. Corbin, I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe there are, but I don't have them handy. I think there are studies that show the non-medical consequences, if that's what you're getting at, the social consequences of people going without insurance and have a deteriorating health status, and I'll see if I can find them.
Hold on, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on my colleague in the Jeff Caucus, the second number you have there for the higher in-hospital mortality, what is driving that? Or is it basically that folks who are uninsured maybe don't have the family support, so that instead of going, how significant is it? Are we saying they don't go home to die, they just stay in the hospital, or what's driving that number?
Representative Merkley, Mr. Chair, that may be a factor, but I think more than that, it's simply that by the time they go into the hospital,
right,
they're so much sicker that it's much more difficult to treat them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Again, I haven't read the study for about 3 years. I'll have to go back and review it, but my memory of it, and I might be wrong, this was that the people are entering the hospital much sicker and couldn't turn the illness around in time to save them. And again, it's not an absolute number of deaths. It's premature deaths, things we'd expect them to recover from in that age as a group, which they didn't. Do I have to go back and look at the study? It's been 3 years, and my memory is banks are empty there.
For uninsured women, as you might expect, the results show up in terms of... diagnosis at a later stage of life-threatening diseases such as breast and cervical cancer, and also a greater likelihood of adverse outcome after giving birth, for the same reasons that I think we've already discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at these page 11, page 12, it occurs to me: do we have data to show the breakdown of uninsured women, uninsured folks by gender, women to females to males, that sort of information? I think it would be helpful to me to get an idea. I mean, are more women going uninsured in Oregon than men, or vice versa?
Representative Dalto, Mr. Chair, we do have that information. It's a year or two old at this point, and we're updating it based on the 2002 Oregon Population Survey. I'm going to with Stevenson, who's right behind me, who's the manager of the research.
If you're gonna say something, please come forward and identify yourself.
I'm Liz Stevenson. I'm the research and data manager for Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. We just got the results of the Oregon Population Survey from 2002, and we should be having the data will be analyzed. We have statistics from 1990 forward on answering those kinds of questions for you, and we should have our data pretty much ready for 2002, I'd say in about a month, within the next month.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess to Dr. Bates or anybody, really, do we have information sort of nationally about access as a pure access issue broken down by gender? In other words, are there access problems? I'm not sure what the question is that I want to ask, but that's kind of my thought.
Mr. Chair, can I respond? I think what you're asking is there more access for males or females in Oregon right now? And I think that would be age-specific when we get the numbers. I think you'll find that probably access for younger females in childbearing age is probably a little higher than males, and that the opposite starts happening in the 50s, where more males probably have private insurance than females do. And I think we'll see a swing back and forth, but it'd be interesting to see those figures where they're at right now. And you'd probably want to see what it looks like under the Medicaid plan, too, for gender also. I think you'd probably want both those figures. So we could probably break it out by insurance type, and it'd be interesting to see what they look like right now, because I don't know what they look like right now. I think I know where you're driving to there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, in follow-up with that study, I read older women tend to access care more frequently than men. Men prefer, like Senator Courtney, not to access care until...
So I just heard you to say that Senator Courtney is one of those that's driving health care costs. Wait till he's, Courtney's the problem.
If he'd gone in earlier.
Thank you, Liz.
Sir, they keep telling me, and I choose to ignore him.
Go ahead, sir.
Oregon insurance status. In Oregon, private insurance insures about 59% of Oregon's population, about 2 million people. Of that, group insurance through employers is about 90%, and individual insurance is about 10%. The Oregon Health Plan insures about 13% of Oregonians. Medicare insures about 14%. And about 14% as of 2002 appear to be uninsured. Now, the rate of folks in Oregon who are uninsured has changed significantly over the recent past. In 1990, it was as high as 16% of Oregonians uninsured. Then came down after the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan. We got it down as low as 10%. And that was in 2000. So over the last couple of years, it has risen back up from 10% uninsurance to about 14% uninsurance.
We have a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. People can be on Medicare and have private insurance, too. Are they included in these figures?
Representative Tomei, they are. I think they would be included as the Medicare insurance, but
they
not
could have,
as well.
But they could have private.
They could have supplemental insurance.
Right.
I don't think that they would be counted twice.
Okay, thank you.
I'll check into that. I can see Representative Bates is asking about that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't want to dominate the conversation. I believe that the primary insurer is always the private insurer, the exception being the Medicare program, where you can be a dual eligible and have Medicare and Medicaid as a backup. I could be wrong about that, but I don't believe you can have private insurance still qualify for the Medicaid program. But that's
Medicare. You can. Medicare can. You can. Private can be reinsurance for Medicare. So.
For Medicare, yes, right. But not Medicaid.
Another question along those lines would be: we have Medicare and Medicaid. There's people both. I mean, have we segregated those out? That's not double counting.
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I believe they are counted twice if they're Medicare and Medicaid.
So the 13% OHP has some overlap with the 14% Medicare?
Correct.
Okay.
Representative Morgan.
So is the overriding governor of this the general economy?
Representative Morgan, Mr. Chair, I believe that is the largest contributing factor to the increase in the number of and percent of Oregonians without health insurance. I think that people who had health insurance through work are beginning to lose it, either because the employer can no longer afford to offer it or because they can't afford to accept the insurance when it is offered. We'll get to this a little bit later in the presentation, but briefly, the economic pressures on employer-sponsored insurance are hitting both employers and employees, and that means that we believe fewer people are being offered health insurance by their employers, and of those who are having it offered, a smaller percentage can afford to accept it because their share of the premium is higher. Now, we also have still in migration into Oregon, the population is growing, and it may be that a large proportion of the folks who have moved to Oregon over the last couple of years are uninsured. So that would be a separate group of people from those who have lost insurance, who've been here for some time.
But as a general rule, would it be fair to say that when the economy is in healthier shape, more people are covered under insurance than when it's in the tank like it is right now?
Representative Morgan, I think that is a fair statement. I think when the economy is strong, employers are much more likely to be able to afford to offer health insurance, and employees are much more likely to be able to afford their share and accept the health insurance. Again, we'll get to this a little bit later in the presentation, but one of the things that makes the situation so bad in Oregon in particular, but nationally, is that the rate of increase in the cost of health insurance and health care is much greater than the rate of increase in the economy. And that means the cost of health care and health insurance are going up faster than either profit to businesses or increases in wages to employees. So both employers and employees are finding it more difficult to pay their share of the cost of employer-sponsored insurance.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. When you say the rate for Hispanics is more than twice the overall rate, does that mean they're primarily, maybe most of them, are not eligible for insurance?
Representative Anderson, I don't know if that's the primary cause. It is certainly one of the causes. Immigration law says that people who came to this country on or after a date which I'm not going to be able to furnish from memory, but it's something like August 22nd, 1996, I believe, cannot, in fact, accept health insurance from the Medicaid program until they've been here for, I believe, 7 years. And then I think that restriction is lifted. For some people, that is what's keeping them from being eligible. In other cases, it's a concern that if anyone in the family gets on a public assistance program, other members of the family may have their chances for citizenship jeopardized. So some of it is, in fact, that they're not eligible. Some of it is that they're concerned that, that this is going to cause problems. However, I think it's also true that there are Hispanic people in Oregon who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and may even know about the Oregon Health Plan, but for whatever reason have simply decided not to apply because they're getting their health care through a safety net clinic, or they've decided they're not going to be in Oregon long enough to make it worthwhile to enroll in a program, whatever reason. There are a number of contributing factors, and a much lower percentage of them have insurance. They're also less likely, by the way, to work for employers who offer health insurance.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. This rate for Hispanics, I'm looking at this, and I'm almost assuming that this probably does, this includes maybe resident aliens and citizens who identify as Hispanic, but probably not folks who aren't citizens or are resident aliens. And so those folks could still show up in a hospital emergency room for a number of reasons. So it could, in fact, even be higher than twice the overall rate, couldn't it? Representative to be substantially Dalton. Higher.
Representative Dalton, I believe that is true. The Oregon Population Survey is a telephone survey, so it excludes people who don't have a telephone. It also excludes people who are uncomfortable discussing things like health insurance over the telephone. So for a number of reasons, you may be right. It may well be higher than that.
Telephone survey.
It is the telephone survey.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want to return to Representative Morgan's question just for a moment and try to flesh that out a bit so it make it understandable to people, because it's an important issue, I believe. When the Oregon Health Plan was first implemented, what it really did was increase the number of people in the plan that would not have been qualified before by taking in non-categoricals, people who were singles and people who had no children, people but who were still under the poverty level. So we had an initial bump up there to about 425,000 people. That number has stayed pretty steady right up to 2 years ago. So we had an initial drop of 2 or 3% of people who were uninsured who became insured through OHP. At the same time, because things happened to fall that way for us, thank goodness, the economy improved. We picked up another 2 or 3% of people who were now insured by their employers who couldn't be insured. So the combination brought us down to around, I think, 10% was our high water mark. Just the opposite is happening now. We have a recession, so people are losing their health insurance work, are losing their work, and now qualifying for the Oregon Health Plan on a financial basis. And so you see caseload going up for the first time probably in the last 6 or 7 years as people lose their jobs and drop into the Oregon Health Plan, and at the same time, less people who have kept their jobs have also kept health insurance because some companies have had to drop health insurance because of the cost of it. So I think that's kind of the double thing. It's wedging in both sides, and now they're wedging away in both sides.
Representative Bates, okay. Mr. Chair, I believe that's exactly right.
Okay.
The compounding effect of the weakening economy and what's happening to the state budget.
Hold on. You got one more?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just indulge me for a moment here. You know, there was a commercial that I'll never forget when a guy named Denny Smith was running for governor, which showed, I guess, homeless people getting on trains coming to Oregon because of the Oregon Health Plan. I didn't forget that, and I still haven't forgotten that. My question is there any data or have there been any studies to look at sort of population migration patterns? Are people coming to Oregon for Oregon Health Plan? Just a curiosity.
Representative Dalto, Mr. Chair, I know that the staff at the Oregon Medical Assistance Programs who run the Medicaid program looked into that at the time. And as I recall, they found evidence of virtually no in-migration for the purposes of getting onto the Oregon Health Plan.
I don't know how you have money to buy a bus ticket here, I guess, if you didn't have health insurance. Just a curiosity. Thank you.
The final point I want to make on insurance status in Oregon is that there are significant variations by region, and these change over time, but some portions of Oregon have a much lower rate of uninsurance than 14%. Some have a much higher rate, and we'll be able to give you that information, as Liz Stevenson said, in about a month. The national insurance status picture is really quite similar to Oregon's now. We used to look significantly better. When we were at about 10%, the national figure was at about 16%. But now, as you'll see, the differences really are that private health insurance is a bit higher nationally than it is in Oregon, but not a lot. Medicaid and Medicare are just a little bit lower, and the uninsured rate is just about the same as Oregon's. So we used to be referred to as sort of a bellwether state in terms of making strides in reducing the percent number of people uninsured. As Representative Bates noted, we lost ground over the last couple of years, and now we look much more like the nation as a whole.
But if Representative Bates's observation about the economy being part of the hydraulic, and we are now with a fairly aggressive leading edge type of program in place developed over a number of years about average with the nation, that would imply that on a national basis the rest of the nation has caught up with us and that most of the nation doesn't have such an aggressive healthcare coverage program as Oregon. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, in a sense, I think it is fair, but the difference, I believe, is that other states have caught up with us somewhat by expanding their Medicaid programs when times were good in the 90s. And, in fact, some states like Washington State and Minnesota have taken their eligibility for their public health insurance programs up as high as 250 or 300% of federal poverty level for families. So they took on a large number of additional people onto their Medicaid or other public health insurance programs. But also I think some other states have still got they've got a higher likelihood now that employers are offering health insurance and employees can afford to accept it with a premium share. And I think that accounts for some of the difference as well. In other words, some states are a little bit ahead of us in terms of private health insurance and may also be a little bit ahead of us in terms of the percent of the low-income population that's covered under their Medicaid programs.
And on a national basis, our economy, you could argue, is worse than other
places. That's right. Among the worst.
I would argue, Mr. Chair, a little differently here. We have
okay. Your time's up.
Okay. Our insurance rate for private and commercial is 4 or 5 percentage points below the national average, which is a significant factor. Our Medicare rates are a little higher, and our Medicaid population is the largest. So we're older, and we're poorer than other states, and getting older and poorer. And when you factor in that Medicare in this state does not pay its full share from the federal government, plus the low Medicaid rates, it puts a huge burden on the commercial market. So that's a very different situation than many, many other states, and allow other states to go much higher in their eligibility requirements because they've got more room to offload those costs. And that's something I'm sure we'll be talking about as weeks go along here. I would argue, Bob, that we look quite a bit different from other states. You disagree with that?
We do look very different from some other states, and I agree with you on the private health insurance. We are below the national average. But I guess my point was just that there was a time when our rate of uninsurance looked quite good, quite a bit better than the national picture, and those days are gone.
Yes.
And then to take, just so I understand, then to take your supposition even further, where we're getting the short shrift on some Medicaid payments, have some
Medicare payments.
Medicare payments, excuse me, that is then shifting part of that cost to the private commercial side, which is driving those rates, which is more expensive, so then there are fewer people that can afford it or choosing to participate in commercial plans.
It's a double hammer. We shrink down the number of, right, of commercial people because they can't afford the premiums, either the employer or the employee, and then we keep offloading more and more on them, making it an unfair system for them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when you said we got short shrift on Medicare, we get a lower per-person compensation than other states?
Massively lower.
Yeah, and let's not go there.
Well, that's another discussion we'll have later. It's massive.
Thank you.
3 times lower than some states.
Incredibly significant.
Thank you.
Unfair.
Yeah, this is a big thing we're all dealing with, and we will. And that's part of what our charge is.
Well, thank God you figured a way to fix that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. I know you're going to present the solution here.
Any moment. That's another mark on Washington.
On page 39.
Yeah, page 39. Go ahead, sir.
Ways to go.
Managed care in Oregon. Oregon has a long history of managed care. Kaiser began in the shipyards in World War II. We've had a higher participation rate in managed care than most states over the last several decades. And in the 80s and 90s, we saw development of HMO products by insurers, as well as closed panel or staff model HMOs like Kaiser.
Now, what's a closed panel?
Closed panel HMO is one in which there's a restriction on which providers, in particular which physicians, a member can see. An open panel is one which gives you much broader choice of physicians than you have in a closed panel.
And then a staff model?
Staff model is an HMO in which the physicians are actually salaried staff of the HMO. There are also HMOs that are based on a physician group model, or the physicians form a group that is part of the health plan.
Sure.
So it comes in a variety of flavors. There was a lot of creativity in the 90s. In terms of creating HMO products by insurers, so that they could participate in managed care. In 1994, I should back up for a minute, in the 1980s, Oregon Medicaid developed a partial capitation model called the Physician Care Organization. Now, what I mean by partial capitation is that the health plans could be based on a group practice of physicians, often as few as, let's say, 8 or 10 physicians in a relatively small community. And their partial capitation was for physician services, but not for hospital services. So the physicians were at risk, if you will. They had to be concerned about the cost of physician services being greater than the capitation they received. They did not have to worry about that for hospital services because the state paid that directly. We moved from that in 1994 with the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan to fully capitated health plans, including mainstream managed care, which expanded about that time from the Willamette Valley to include most of the state. At one time, I think there were only one or two counties that were not managed care for the Oregon Health Plan in the mid-90s. So it pretty much blanketed the state for a brief period of time. However, that didn't last more than a couple of years, and then health plans began moving out of those service areas outside the Willamette Valley, pulling back into the Willamette Valley. But in the meantime, there were locally based, fully capitated health plans that had developed in order to serve the OHP population that remained. They were based usually on a partnership between the local hospital and local physicians. And they...
hold on, Bob.
Yes.
Steve, could you just kind of clarify when you're talking fully capitated health plan and HMO, the vernacular, so we're all on kind of the same page, that they're basically the same what I should be understand about the concept.
Before we go, Mr. Chair, I sure will. I'm sorry. HMO, or Health Maintenance Organization, is a model that tries to link, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, the insurance function with the function of providing care, and tries to maintain health by making sure that people come in to the provider regularly and stay enrolled and have ongoing care with good continuity. The fully capitated health plans were plans that were developed for the Oregon Health Plan but did not get certified by the federal government as health maintenance organizations. Instead were regulated by the state and met state requirements for how they would assure that they had enough provider capacity, how they identified their service area, what kind of risk reserves they had in case they hit a number of very expensive cases. And it's those fully capitated health plans that make up the bulk of the contractors now in the Oregon Health Plan. They enroll by far most of the managed care enrollees in the plan.
Is that Care Oregon, COIS?
Correct. Intercommunity? Yes.
Okay.
Just to make that a little more understandable to people, there's three major factors in the cost of health care. It's provider services, physicians, nurse practitioners, it's pharmaceutical costs, and there's hospital inpatient and outpatient costs. And most people understand fully capitated plans to say that entity that's taking care of those capitated patients will receive a certain amount of money each month, and they will take the risk for managing the pharmaceutical costs, the hospital costs, and the physician costs. And that's a fully capitated plan because you're capitated for all the health service that patient's going to receive. Usually there's a carve-out for mental health. And I don't know if there's any capitated plans that include mental health right now in the state. But there are probably one or two. And I could be wrong on that. I think there are a couple, but it varies. Okay. So that space, fully capitated, usually means what I've just defined. Would you agree, Bob?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for those of us in the remedial class, capitated, meaning you pay a certain amount per person in the plan versus per procedure? Yes.
Representative Merkley, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Capitation is a monthly payment to the health plan for each member enrolled in the health plan. And the capitation is...
So the contractor gets this money regardless of what services they provide?
Representative Merkley, okay. That is correct.
Thank you.
When folks like Regents dropped out and we went to IPAs, did the amount of capitalization for risk change, or is it still the same? I mean, that's got to be a struggle for some of these small IPAs to have the resources. I mean, did that change, or did we modify that to allow them to operate?
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I think you may be asking two questions.
Okay.
If I'm understanding right, the first one is, are the requirements the same for the plans in the Oregon Health Plan versus plans like Regents, which have commercial lines of business, in terms of their risk reserves?
Right.
And they're not the same. The requirements are different for plans in the Oregon Health Plan. The requirements for reserves for financial stability, I think, have not changed much over time with the Oregon Health Plan. But I would defer to folks from the Oregon Health Plan. I know you're going to have a presentation from the folks who administer that program, and I don't want to misinform you, so I'm going to defer to them.
Okay.
To answer.
All right. And I know that there's some creative bookkeeping, reserving part of payments and different things like that, so they have the reserve. So I'm just wondering if the numbers were different, and because clearly I'm not sure how a small IPA can have the capital assets of a major health insurance organization. So,
thank you for popping that as well. Thank you, Chair. Can you do kind of a real quick 101 then, when we're talking about risk and kind of what some of these plans have to have and back them in terms of taking risk for these plans, and this what can happen if demand exceeds what they actually are being paid?
Mr. McCorby and Mr. Chair, I'm not going to speak to the exact requirements for risk reserves. There are other people who can do that. Again, I don't want to misinform you. I'll get that information for you at a later time, but I don't have it currently. Typically, what's required is something on the order of 2 or 3 months worth of total capitation payments, or some multiple of months capitation payments in total as a risk reserve. Now, the amount of risk reserves necessary really varies depending on the population you're insuring and what the real risk is that the costs are going to exceed the capitation payment. But the point of having risk reserves is that if a plan has a month or two in which the cost of care for the enrolled population is significantly higher than what had been predicted and what went into developing the capitation rates, they can weather that storm. And then presumably they'll have some good months when they can recoup and build the reserves back up. So that's the purpose of that requirement. And it is, you know, it's a requirement for health plans participating in the Oregon Health Plan that they have reserves. I can't tell you the exact requirement at this time.
Very much like a commercial insurance company.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Okay. Managed care in Oregon, we still have significant levels in commercial, Medicaid, and Medicare populations. Medicare managed care, often in nowadays referred to as Medicare Plus Choice, is constrained in Oregon in terms of participation by the low Medicare premiums. Now, this, again, is something I think you're going to want to get into in more detail, I can tell later on. But for now, I just want to acknowledge that, in fact, Oregon's Medicare payment for managed care is extremely low. It's calculated as something called the Adjusted Average Per Capita Cost, or AAPCC, which is calculated at the county level and takes into account factors like the age of the recipient or the beneficiary, institutional status, whether they're in assisted living or long-term care, Medicaid eligibility, and so forth. The purpose of the AAPCC is to establish a fair capitation rate for Medicare beneficiaries in different categories of need for care, if you will, as much as that can be predicted by actuaries. The problem Oregon has is that we have done, historically, a very good job of containing costs of care for Medicare beneficiaries. So since the actuaries look at the experience in a given state and a given county as the basis for determining how much is going to be paid to the managed care plans that enroll Medicare beneficiaries. And since our experience includes very low costs, that means our AAPCC is very low compared with other states. Now, one of the results of this is that it's difficult for health plans to make it within the AAPCC. There's very little margin for error or for bad luck. It also makes it very difficult for Medicare managed care plans in Oregon to do what plans do in other states, which is to say, essentially, we'll cover all of the Medicare benefits you're used to getting, and we'll cover some of your prescription drugs, and we'll cover some of the co-payments or cost-sharing you might have to pay for Medicare. This makes it much more likely that people will decide to go into the managed care plan rather than stay on fee-for-service Medicare. So it's meant that growth in Medicare managed care in Oregon has been difficult. In a nutshell, we've been punished in the AAPCC for having done a good job previously in containing the cost of care for Medicare beneficiaries.
And this is the root of Representative Merkley's question of the disparity in payment.
Yes.
Well, and I think it would be very interesting. You say we're being punished, but clearly Medicare's got a defined pot of money nationally, and it's interesting that the states with rather large congressional delegations have high reimbursement rates, and the states with rather low congressional delegations don't. So there's some pure politics that plays into this, too.
Now, Bob, I apologize for doing this, but Representative March has asked me that you go over this page again, just so he makes sure that he understands.
15 and 39, wasn't that it? That's what I'm going to say.
No, yeah, but I think this is a critical component in where we are in one of our problems. And I don't understand this Medicare managed care is constrained. I don't understand the Medicare plus choice issue.
Mr. Chair, fair enough. I'll explain to the best of my ability what's going on here, but I'd encourage you to also invite others who are directly involved in Medicare plus choice plans who are dealing with this daily to explain the effects, the impact on managed care plans and on Medicare. But I'll explain it to the limits of my understanding.
Okay. Representative March would appreciate that.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The premium that is paid to the Medicare managed care plans by the federal government is based on what's happened in Oregon in Medicare over the previous years.
Right.
And it's based on experience that reflects the fact that we have contained costs for Medicare more effectively than many other states. So our premium rates are quite low compared with many other states.
Yeah, by premium, you mean payment?
Payment to the health plans by the federal government. That's right.
Okay. Representative March understands that part.
And in part, I understand that because Oregon had a high percentage of people in HMOs, which helped keep costs down.
Yeah. Kaiser and the whole thing when this thing started in 65.
Exactly.
No, it's 65.
That's when
Medicare started.
That's when it started. That's not the year that they based the reimbursement rates on. That was in the 80s.
The update. They started
in 60s. In 80?
They rebased, but they started in the 60s, 65.
Right, but the rebase, the rates that we currently have were established in the 80s, I think, weren't they? Over statistics.
The managed
the 80s?
Care representatives right. For the managed care AAPCC that did come into being in the 80s.
Right.
But it's been trended forward
right. For
each period since then.
Maybe we should define a term that I've always had a little trouble with the federal government, but a lot of trouble with the federal government in different terms, but this is one of them. Costs versus what they pay us. And they will often base what they pay us on what they used to pay us and not the true cost of the program. And that's the key problem here. And what Bob's trying to get to is that initially in 65 or thereabouts, the Dartmouth study laid out what they're going to pay us based on what they thought the costs were in different areas of Oregon. They were set extremely low. Continuing that trend, when they did the AAPC, they continued the same trend based on what they paid us, not what our costs were. And then from that point, there's been a 2 or 3% increase over the years as inflation came in. If you start at a low base and you compound that, it just keeps getting wider and wider and wider. And what's happened in Oregon and in states like Oregon, because there are several others, we're not the only ones, companies that run HMOs have come in here, tried to make a go of it, and found out the cost of doing business, the true cost of doing business, is not the same as what they get paid with the federal government, and they've left the state because they kept losing too much money. The federal government decided to ignore that effect. While in other areas of the country, the HMOs, such as in Florida and New York and some parts of Texas and California, had huge profits, even though they offered to those patients there the same program with no deductibles, no copays, pharmaceuticals covered, eyeglasses covered, dental covered, and they still made huge amounts of money. So the disparity between what they pay the states versus what those costs are significantly different. If you're in a state like Oregon where your costs are higher than your pay from the federal government and your population is larger than most other states because we're an older state, it really hammers you. And that's what you're trying to get to, I think.
Representative Bates, that's correct. I think the factor of utilization control in Oregon was a large part of how we were able to contain costs. Mm-hmm. States that had no utilization controls then enjoyed a much wider margin. And as soon as they began using managed care, they realized there was a lot that they could control, and that meant that they could keep easily within the AAPCC.
Well, and I think the confusion of one of the individuals that's sitting on one of the sides of Mr. Bukovian was the word premium, mm-hmm. and I'm going, like, I'd pay a premium to an insurance company for my coverage. If you insert payment there, that makes
good.
Perfect sense to me.
Good. Managed care enrollment in Oregon. Total enrollment in managed care is about 1,334,000, or about 40% of Oregonians. In private insurance, it's about 44% of the total. In the Oregon Health Plan, about 73% of the total. That's down compared with some of the years that we had in the mid to late 90s, when it was as high as 85%, I believe, or even 90%. Still, nearly three-quarters of the OHP is enrolled in managed care. In Medicare, about 167,000. It's about 35% of the Medicare beneficiaries.
Are you going to... Yeah, Mr. Chair. So Medicare plus choice risk is... What is choice risk?
Medicare plus choice risk is a contract where the health plan is actually at risk in the sense that it's capitated. And Medicare plus choice cost is, again, I'm not an expert on this. I would encourage
so we'll
you
hear that
more
later.
Detail later from
Thank
someone
you.
Who's actually operating one of these health plans. The health plan is not fully at risk, but is paid in part based on its actual cost.
Okay. Thank you.
Healthcare costs in Oregon. This will speak to some of the differences we're talking about in the cost of healthcare in Oregon as compared with the nation and with other states. Our healthcare costs in Oregon are relatively low, and that's true in general. Annual per capita costs in Oregon in 1998 were $3,234, compared with $3,750 for the nation, and as an example of some other states, $4,085 in Florida and $4,661 in New York.
That includes Medicare and Medicaid in the cost. So the low reimbursement rate puts us behind the eight ball, and we can't escape because their costs will always be higher because they're getting more federal money to start with.
Yeah.
So, and that's the driver.
The double-edged sword that cuts both ways with one swipe.
Yeah. In Medicaid, we're
all... That's what now we'll have to think about for a while.
...by quite a bit, $3,167. Per person in Oregon, $3,882 for the nation. And a couple of states that are also significantly higher, North Dakota, $5,450, New York, $7,180. For Medicare, I did not include, I meant to, the per capita annual cost from a couple of other states. I will get that for you. But Oregon is at $4,337. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Bob, just to make sure we're making ourselves clear, the first item is annual per capita costs overall, and that's true cost. That's what people actually, if you average it all out, private and Medicaid, Medicare, what the real costs are. The next two bullets are what is paid against those programs and not necessarily what the cost of taking care of those patients are. Is that correct?
Representative Bates, I'm not certain. I think this may be using the term cost to reflect.
Hold on. We have someone from the peanut gallery who wants to comment. Mr. Spate, come on up.
Mr. Chair, does the person have to be bald to testify before this committee? I'm just
Mr. Chairman,
but in this business for 10 years, you are bald. Okay.
I'm working on it.
You notice the familiarity here.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spade with Kaiser Permanente. I would just point, I believe these numbers reflect average per capita expenditures in Oregon.
We're talking the first bullet here.
All three bullets are annual per capita expenditures, so it would be the sum of all public and private expenditures made for health care in Oregon. The next one would be a comparison of those made by state Medicaid programs, that is, the expenditures by the state for Medicaid. And the third would be the expenditures made by the Medicare program in the state of Oregon compared to nationally. So it's an expenditure, it's the cost to the payer. The cost difference that Representative Bates is bringing up is the difference between the cost to the payer, which is an expenditure, and the cost that the provider bears. And you have to continually ask yourself as you walk through this, when somebody uses cost, make sure you ask whose cost they're talking about. I believe this data reflects expenditures based upon the public and private payers. So I believe so, too.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I want it noted that
hold
I would have
hold
thought.
Hold on. Don't go away.
Wait a minute.
Representative Morgan. Right. Do this over again.
Okay. Again, for the remedial class.
Thank you for helping me out here.
The first bullet point that talks about annual per capita costs in Oregon, that reflects what it actually costs us in the state of Oregon to provide service. Is that correct or not correct?
Representative Morgan, Chair Westland, the only quibble, and it's a substantial quibble, but it's a quibble, that I would make with this page is that for clarity, I would put, wherever it says costs, I would put expenditures. So that the sub-bullet point would say the annual per capita expenditure in Oregon was $3,234. With that clarification, I believe it answers your question. That would be, on average, what Medicare, Medicaid, every private insurer, and self-pay patients paid for hospital, physician, pharmaceutical, and other healthcare services.
So then would it also be fair to say in the second and third bullet points that you could say that the annual per capita reimbursement for Medicaid to Oregon, that's not true?
Oh.
I would.
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative Morgan and Chair Westland, I would be careful putting in reimbursement.
Yeah.
Again, I believe this data, the way it's acquired nationally, and I believe this comes from
Henry T. Kaiser Foundation.
Well, and right. This reflects what the various public and private payers of health care have actually paid out. This, you're raising another important concept in the economics of healthcare, and that's the difference between expenditures, reimbursement, and the underlying cost concepts that Representative Bates has laid out. But I think that to be just absolutely clear about what this data is trying to portray and those that put it together is it's an expenditure based upon the payer. In a very narrow sense, you are right. It's what they paid, and therefore it's somebody else's reimbursement. I'm just saying that the database this came from wouldn't use the same term you're using. But you're getting close to a concept that I think you'll get into, and that is there's expenditures by somebody. They are paid to somebody, and that becomes reimbursement. And then the difference between reimbursement and the underlying cost is either a positive gap or a negative gap. And if it's a positive gap, you won't hear providers of health care talking too much about it. If it's a negative gap, you'll hear a lot about it, whether it's either the public sponsor or a private sponsor.
Which gets us into cost shift and all the other problems in the system.
And so, again, back to the first bullet,
that's part of the problem when you say expenditure in Oregon, and part of that is driven by the low Medicaid numbers.
That is correct.
Or reimbursements or premiums, to use Bob's word.
Or expenditures.
Or expenditures. Is that a true statement? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, if you're looking at the figure 3167 compared to the national figure of 3882,
mm-hmm.
I would characterize those differences. Again, it's on a per capita, so we're taking the number of Medicaid beneficiaries out of the equation, and we're talking what does it cost or what was the expenditure for a single on a per capita basis, and there's about a $700 difference there. I would, off the top of my bald head, interpret the $700 difference to be a combination of both the unit price that our Medicaid programs have paid over the years, and the number of services that our Medicaid programs have paid for over the years, which is the latter, the number of services, is a function of how physicians and other healthcare providers practice medicine. I agree with everything that Bob is saying and has said, but there's one other factoid, and that whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial insurance, healthcare in Oregon and the Northwest and in the West generally compared to Florida and New York is quite different relative to the number of units of service produced out of this non-system. And we can get you data to show that, but understanding that the number of units that our healthcare system in Oregon produces is different from the number of units that a New York healthcare system produces for the same population is, in fact, this national dichotomy of why is healthcare for 65-year-olds different in Oregon than it is. And part of it is the number of units. And so these differences
units
are both
roughly translated as benefits.
Not just benefits, but the number of office visits in a year. The number of
Hospital bed days.
How frequently people are admitted to a hospital and how quickly they get out of the hospital. Healthcare providers in Oregon practice differently than in other parts of the country. I think that's a fair statement that I'd look to.
I'm going to try to put this in a little different terms so you can tease out of these figures what Bob is trying to get to. The first bullet tells us that the Oregon healthcare system, Medicare, Medicaid, private, everything, is much more efficient than the nation as an average. And that's what you're seeing here. Because we get the same outcomes or better outcomes as far as mortality and morbidity as any other state in the nation, but we get it much more efficiently. Okay, so that's the first bullet. Because you're comparing your overall system, the overall system in any other state, and on an average, we're much better. And that $500 or $600 may not look like much, but when you spread it over the population of 3 million people, you're talking a substantial amount of money. The next two bullets are what we expend on these two programs. I think expenditures is a good answer. Probably in the second bullet, we're putting a certain amount of money out as an expenditure, but the actual cost of taking care of those people is probably substantially more than that expenditure, and that is shifted. Third bullet, same story. Medicare is probably the actual cost of taking care of those people is more than the expenditure, and we shift that to the private sector. Okay? But the overall system is hanging together in the state because our hospital stays are shorter, our doctor visits are shorter, utilization of drugs are less, and the overall system is more efficient and still produces excellent outcomes. Is that something you'd agree with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, generally I would agree with you.
Thank you. I'm trying to make it layman's here. We've got a long ways to go.
You need 202 with me, too.
Oh, well.
We've got some things
wrong. We have some things we disagree with.
But wouldn't it be safe to say, Barney, that the... I mean, you're talking about East Coast, West Coast, and a number... I mean, they utilize the system more because they get closer to true cost, so they can afford to utilize it more. Am I off base there?
Let me clarify, Mr. Chairman and Representative Cruz. One of the fundamental equations in healthcare and economics is very simple. And if you think about this and remember this, and I write it on the back of my, I have write it on the back of my hand for 20 years, the number of units of service times the cost per service equals the total cost. So if you're looking at how much do we expend for hospitals, mm-hmm. it would be the number of hospitals days in a year times the average cost per day will equal the total amount of expenditure for hospitals. So there are two fundamental, in that algebraic equation, there are two fundamental drivers. One will be the cost of a day, in this. The other will be the frequency that people are admitted and how long they stay in the hospital, using my this example.
Right.
And so when you think about costs, you basically, I would urge you to continue to think about where are the price trends of a unit of service going and where are the utilization trends, that is, how frequently is the service, and it can be a physician office visit, it can be a script, it can be a day in the hospital, it can be frequency of durable medical. And that's how premiums are built. And that's how actuaries look at all of this, is not as both at the how the unit cost is changing, and Bob and others can go, and particularly those in the Medicaid program, can tell you what they're seeing as far as the underlying drivers of the cost side. And then there are utilization drivers as far as the frequency of the utilization, and the combined those together are the cost. Now, where I would say, back to your point, one of the big cost differences in New York is not only their unit prices are higher, mm-hmm. they charge higher, but they also, and this is the point that Representative Bates was making, they use the services more frequently, so the utilization is higher. On a say,
right.
for every 1,000 members in, put in Medicare, Medicaid, New York Blue Cross, their utilization for the same age group is higher than the utilization you'll find in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, the West generally, but particularly the Northwest. Is that,
and that isn't driven at all by how close to true cost the reimbursement is? I mean, for example, if a hospital's losing money on a patient in Oregon and they aren't losing money on a patient in New York for a procedure where there may be a 3-day stay in New York, there's only going to be a 2-day stay in Oregon, so that the loss is less. I mean, you know, you can talk about frequency, but you know, does that play into it? In other words, you know, a physician is more likely, or a hospital is more likely to keep somebody they're getting paid for than somebody they're not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, there's a dimension to what you're saying that I would agree with you.
Okay.
I would have to say, in all honesty, it's a small dimension, and I'll talk to you more about that if you'd like.
Okay.
But if you look at the utilization of healthcare services across different geographic areas, and there's been some really fine studies done of that, particularly in Medicare, where the Medicare payment is generally fixed. I'm not talking about Medicare Plus Choice, where the Medicare payment is generally fixed except for local geographic variables like cost of labor. You'll see substantial undescribable. You'll see substantial variation in the use of medical resources that are inexplicable given both mortality rates and sicknesses. That is, it's inexplicable of why New York uses inpatient hospitals 3 to 4 times more frequently than we do in Oregon or in Washington or in Idaho. Some of it may, in fact, be a dimension of that, but most of it, I would argue, is that the practice of medicine here is different than the practice of medicine.
So it's cultural.
It's cultural. And there have been studies over the last 25 years to try to understand why it's different. And even physicians who are educated in the East and come to the West to practice medicine will adopt Western practice patterns relative to the use of these resources. I would defer to the licensed physician.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And if you reward behavior that says the longer in the hospital, the more money you get, then yours becomes true, and it has become true. So you have a different culture, and then you reward the wrong culture. In the state of Oregon, you can look at different areas of certain types of diagnoses and see wide variations, even in our own state, of what's done that diagnosis. For a number of tonsillectomies in one town will be different than the other. prostate surgeries. You can go right down the line of what gets done, lumpectomy versus mastectomy, and it's and there's no rational reason for it. It's something that medicine is grappling with now.
Well, it goes back to the 1800s, doesn't it?
Sometimes I think we're no better than we were then.
Representative Mark.
The Representative Morgan used the word reimbursement, and I just wanted to caution. I think if you use that word, people think we're getting reimbursed at Medicaid at $31.67, and obviously the feds only are putting up 60% of that. So we'd want to stay away from that word.
Hold on, Barney. Just Representative Merkley.
Go.
You didn't have a question?
I did.
But Representative Tomei does.
I do.
Hold on, Barney. We're going to stop in a minute because, I mean, this has been a large amount of information to assimilate. Maybe if
you've got questions on page 39,
Bob,
can
get
right
through the the next sheet.
I thought I understood what you were saying. I just want to make sure that on the second bullet, when we're talking about the expenditure for Medicaid, that is the true expenditure. It's not what we've been reimbursed or what we bill. It is the true expenditure. Is that true?
For
that bullet and the next bulletin. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct. I think Barney's point is important, and that is there's a language problem here. The source I took this information from was talking about costs in terms of, if you will, the cost of the purchaser, all the purchasers. What are they paying? How much is being expended is a better way of looking at it. So if you substitute expenditures for costs, what you're talking about then
is the
is
true cost.
The what was spent for this care.
Right.
Now, you might get an argument from the provider about whether the expenditures are enough to cover the cost of care
right. In
terms of how much it costs the provider to provide it. So I think Barney's point is very important. I apologize for the unclear language. These, I'm sure, although they use the term cost in the source that I took this from, I think they meant the cost to the purchaser, which really translates into the expenditure by the purchasers, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare or private coverage, private payers. So when I redo this, and I will, it will say annual per capita expenditures.
Thank you.
Across the board.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Next panel.
It's an easy one.
Good.
Thank you, Representative. It's all over.
Having, you know, talked about the problem with language in that last one, I want to make it clear that I agree with Representative Bates' point that in Oregon we have done a good job of keeping costs down, and that's, you know, true in Medicare, as we discussed. I think it's also true across the board. But they're still growing. So even though we may be a lower-cost state than most, regarding most populations, our costs are going up. And judging from recent increases in private health insurance, what employers and employees are seeing is increases in the double digits per year for the premiums for group coverage, and growth in costs in Medicaid. What we're seeing in Oregon is very similar to what's being seen nationally, and that is costs are going up at an alarming rate. So,
percentage-wise, we're about on par with other states?
I believe so.
Have you broken that out between states with tort caps and states without?
States with
tort caps and states without tort caps.
No, I have not, Representative Cruz, but I'll look at that.
That would be an interesting
question. Good question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a question. At some point in the next few sessions here, we're going to go over the costs that are driving the increases in health care. I know there are a couple of spreadsheets that show medical inflation, you know, pharmaceutical costs, all sorts of, you know, the tort happens to be, I think, a small component of what's actually driving it right now in Oregon, but are we going to go over that at some point in the future?
Representative Dalto, yes, I'll start the discussion on that, and others who follow me will also talk about what's driving health care costs up, but you're right, there are a number of factors at work.
Thank you.
Yeah, these presentations, and we're going to stop here. I mean, this has been a lot of information to assimilate.
It's fine.
You will be tested first thing tomorrow morning. This is going to come from, we're going to get this from a lot of different sides, some of the same points, same conditions, same cost drivers, same structure. It's all very interrelated, but we're going to take this thing, think of it as kind of like a crystal, and there's multi facets to that. We're going to look at it from each side, and this is just the first one.
If I could add to your comments, Mr. Chair, most of you probably feel like you're drinking from a fire hose right now, but it does get better because you'll get the worst of this behind you, and it'll start making a little bit more sense to you. It really will. It really will. It will get better to understand. Hang in there.
Anyone else have any questions for Bob? If not, I think we'll start. In fact, maybe we'll just recap the health care costs in Oregon, start back here again tomorrow. And
very well.
3 o'clock. No other business coming before the committee? We're adjourned.